You're tuned into the Awakening Zone Radio Network, your news and information source for empowered spiritual awakening.
Hello, this is Karen Elkins, and this is Science to Sage Radio. And today our guest is Wes Marlin, PhD. Wes is a scientist, educator, and founder of corporations and foundations that are focused on diverse water quality projects. He is the author of 3 books and author of many articles, especially some in Science to Sage magazine. His books are Universal Water, Hydro Mimicry, I think it's hydromimic. I did it right. Strategies for Water, Planet, and Alternative Perception. So welcome, Wes.
Thank you so much, Karen.
You know what? One thing I've actually liked about Wes's books, especially the one on Universal Water, which all his books that kind of take you back to it, is there's an understanding that takes you from ancient wisdom to modern science. He bridges the two in a way that I haven't seen anybody do that before. But before we start with that, Wes, you said one thing to me one time that kind of stuck with me, and you said, I think I've learned more being in the water than just studying the water. So would you want to explain that for me a little bit?
Yeah. A lot of my academic career has been studying water, either the chemistry of water, the ecology of water, or, the physics of water. But actually, my interest in water started much earlier, and that was I grew up in Southern California and later in life moved to Hawaii, so I have been quite an avid surfer. So among swimming and surfing and other ways of being in the water, it was really sort of a tranquil experience for me, and sometimes I'd sit on my surfboard, just run my hands through the water. And, I felt a connection there that was, something both undeniable and something that was really pleasurable. And so for a long time, I've been just whenever I need to get away from it all and sort of go back to nature and go back to myself, I find that water really enhances my ability to do so.
So that, I think that maybe if you were in Hawaii, that part of your books have a lot to do with the indigenous roots and the perceptions that the ancients had about water that obviously you've been able to sense. But you also in your books go into depth about the different cultural insights. Can you give us an idea? Because you go into the Hindu, the Chinese, the Greek, the Egyptian, the Hawaiians, the Maori, et cetera. So why don't you give us some insights to what it is that the ancients would have had to say to us about water?
Okay. Well, without having to go into each one of those individually, there are some common threads that run through ancient and even modern indigenous people's views of water that are significantly different than the way that particularly Western people and throughout the world, people from industrialized civilizations look at it. And my interest in looking at the ancient views of water was to see if there were some basic perceptual differences between how they viewed water and how they treated water and how we view water and how we treat water. And I guess the first thing is that water in many of the ancient texts was used as a metaphor for what we might call the absolute or sort of the limitless space and undifferentiated forms from which everything comes. And it's interesting that they used water as the metaphor for this because it was their belief that through the physical substance of water came everything in the universe. And so from the sort of the metaphoric waters of chaos, which is what the Greeks referred to it as, and many cultures have referred to it as the waters of chaos, this absolute storehouse of everything then comes through the substance of water as a function of geometry and vibration and other kinds of ways in which energy is transformed into what we call form, that was known to be water. And so for them, the substance of water was truly sacred. It was sacred because it was where they came from, at least on a physical sense, and where everything else that they believed that they saw in the physical world actually came from. So when they treated the substance of water, it wasn't just a commodity. It wasn't just something that was needed by their bodies. It wasn't just something that transported wastes. It was actually the stuff from which everything in our manifested world emerged. And because of that, they had a reverence for water and treated it in a way in which they wouldn't degrade it, because they considered that to be sacrilegious, since water was sacred. We in the industrialized world have lost that sort of sense of water, and whether or not the ancients were accurate in the way that they described the water, certainly their perception of water allowed them to live much more sustainably with the earth and with the water than we do. And so one of the things that I wanted to do was to look at these various cultures and see what it is about their perceptions that allowed them to treat and live with water in ways different than we do.
You know what reminds me of, Wes, when I've looked at what makes water, which is the hydrogen and the oxygen, and you go back to the elemental understanding of the elements plus ether, and if what Gerald Pollack kind of connotes is that three things make everything and that we're basically made of elements, then wouldn't they be right?
Well, it's interesting. A lot of the ancient cultures went back to this idea of a trinity, and it started with maybe the Greek trinity. I mean, there's lots of trinities, each, you know, Father, Son, Spirit in the Christian tradition. If we go into more of the ancient Greek tradition, it was chaos, Gaia, and Eros. And the chaos, again, refers to this absolute, which many ancient cultures associated with water. Gaia, which is not only the name of the earth itself, but more generally a representation of manifested forms. So here again, we're going from the absolute to the manifested forms through Eros, which was the moving force of love. And it's usually considered that either love creates or the opposite of love can uncreate. And in this world, it's not a matter of good or bad. Everything that's created has to at some point be uncreated and go back to the waters of chaos. So I think the Trinity comes in there. You know, I think that the whole idea of, you know, that we have freshwater, seawater, and atmospheric water, clouds, that whole kind of trinity works on a global scale, so that water is constantly moving through these different compartments. So I think it's applicable in a number of different ways.
Well, that kind of reminds me of the recycling, in the sense, is what you're talking about, liquid, solids, and gases, that energy never dies. So, I mean, when I look at some of this life everlasting, when we look at that concept, it would hold true, I would believe.
Yeah, water cycles, as does everything else, but the water cycling is even probably, in my view, even more profound, because it's the phase changes of water that are very much determine you know, what goes on this planet. In fact, the energy for this planet is of course provided by the sun, but it's actually the phase changes of water going from solid to liquid to gas and then back to liquid and then back to solid that sets up many of the energy dynamics that runs the compartments or the major systems on the earth. So it is very much a question of these three, whether we're talking about three phases of water, whether we're talking about the movement between those phases, or whether we're talking about sort of the metaphoric act of creation and uncreation itself.
You made a comment about in your book, and I don't know why I want to jump to this for a second, but what makes hydrogen one and what makes oxygen? You said one comes from the concept of the Big Bang and one comes from the stars. Can you explain that?
Yeah, the two atomic components of water, of course, oxygen and hydrogen, Right now, the belief among physicists is that hydrogen actually is a function of the Big Bang. And so when the Big Bang occurred, at least that's one theory of what of the genesis of the universe, is that there was subatomic particles and energy and everything that went on. As that started to move out and cool, as it moved away from the source of the Big Bang and expanded into what's now our universe, some of these subatomic particles started to coalesce. The simplest atom that we know of is hydrogen, which is just one proton and then one electron that's around it. So it looks like hydrogen is the first atom that was ever formed, and it's been around for a very long time. Oxygen is a more recent addition, and oxygen occurs, is born actually within dying stars. It's called red giants, which is really sort of the end of life of a star. When these giants explode, they have formed through the addition of hydrogen and helium molecules, various heavier molecules like oxygen, like nitrogen, like carbon. And when those explode, then they're released out into interstellar space. So basically, we're looking at water as being one of the simplest molecules that's created from a component of the Big Bang and a component of exploding stars.
Yeah, I was just thinking that, because it would be if those two things make water, because that's what water is made of, then I would assume that the universe is abundant with it.
Yeah, surprisingly it is. It used to be believed that water was pretty much a purview of the Earth and of places where you might find temperatures that were conducive to liquid water. And that is probably still true, but water occurs in both its vapor form and in its and its solid form throughout the universe. So on comets and asteroids and even within interstellar space, on particulates, you can have solid phase water. As you move closer to stars or areas of the universe where it's much hotter, then water can exist as a gas, as a vapor. Even in the cooler areas of some of the stars, even our sun they've detected water in the so-called sunspots, which are actually cooler parts of the photosphere of the sun.
Well, there are a couple thoughts that come to mind. One is like in the biblical, in the Bible, they basically say that, you know, God divided the heaven and the earth, but it's still basically water. One's just a finer form of the other. Is that true? So you're talking, I talk about that fifth element about being ether, would that be a finer form of what we understand as water, like in the oceans?
Well, you know, it's hard to know, but what we can sort of figure out, or what anthropologists and ancient scholars have surmised, is that the whole idea of the ether goes back to some aspect of the unseen world, so that when we look around us, what we see is the material world, but there's an ancient understanding that in addition to that material world that we can see that's formed, there's actually a part of the material world that is so-called etheric, and it's through that etheric form of the world is through which things emerge. Now, it's interesting that the Greeks, again, going back to various kinds of Platonic solids, associated the icosahedron with water and the dodecahedron with ether. And those two, both mathematically and geometrically, are very much related. One is sort of the spatial inverse of the other. And in many ancient cultures, what we see is this feeling that the unmanifested ether is oftentimes represented by the actual substance of water. The Hawaiians are one that had done that. They refer to the etheric substance as mana, and then their word for water is vai. And when they try to explain how the etheric energies or etheric substance or however they envisioned it moves through the body or moves through the earth or moves through the environment, they always use water as a metaphor, so that water was sort of the visual, tactile, material counterpart of this part of the world they called the etheric that they weren't able to actually see or sense. And so that's an interesting kind of subplot that moves through this whole idea that water is more than what we attribute to it as just a simple molecular substance.
You say the Mayans apparently believe that the solar energy downloaded information with the Earth's electric and magnetic fields playing out in the watery bodies of living organisms, which would be like this, that the solar code was believed to be in the form of harmonics. So it's actually like wave functioning still acting. And because every time I see science, it's this wave-like function. It's like, well, is it or isn't it? And it seems to me like, yeah, well, why don't you just call it what it is?
Yeah, this whole idea between about basically fire and water or sun and water or heat and water is one that, again, appears very often and in very different kinds of ways throughout history. But, you know, even if we look at something like the water in stars, water in the outer photosphere of stars is able to absorb some of the wavelengths of light that's released by the stars and then transmit other ones right through it. So there's this ability of water to interact with light or with heat, and particularly light, in such a way that it often acts as a kind of a filter. So, you know, questions have been asked for many, 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 many years, what is the interaction between light and water and heat and water? And of course, when we deal with light, then we're dealing from a scientific viewpoint with whether light is a wave or whether it's a particle. and at some level, that it's both.
Yes.
It depends on how you look at it. If you're looking for a wave, you see a wave. If you're looking for a particle, you see a particle. And so it's been described by both. But certainly the ability for light and various kinds of radiation, not only what we call visible light, but all kinds of electromagnetic radiation to interact with water is well described in the scientific literature.
But I would think that in its sense is actually fundamental to it all, considering it's made of light and hydrogen, right? So it's the fundamental part that actually is water.
Well, water, yeah. I mean,
that's what I find so interesting.
From its roots, it certainly is water from a physical standpoint. Certainly is composed of oxygen and hydrogen, at least the water molecule is. And if you look at the genesis of those, certainly you could say that the oxygen born in the stars came from light. And depending on how you envision the Big Bang, that the hydrogen will, of course, come from light as well. And it's interesting that that water responds to, as I said, a whole range of electromagnetic radiation, things like microwaves, things like X-rays, things like visible light, even, and it does so not only on the basis of individual H2O molecules. A lot of us think of water as just being a, sort of a random mix of these water molecules that move around very quickly and, you know, in sort of a haphazard way. And in fact, water is not that at all. Water is a highly sophisticated, very complex network where individual water molecules connect to their nearest neighbors in a way that's not only very dynamic, but also very, many times, very geometric.
Well, here's a question for you because, I just lost the thought. Darn. That, I know what it is. Okay, you're talking about the geometric forms, which goes into the you talk very much about the pyramidal structure and then the fractal nature. So why don't you explain that? Because, again, I know what it was. When Gerald Pollack said, we think our body as two-thirds water, but in actuality, when you look at the cells and all of the things that make us all up, we're 99.9% water is what we are. So to think that we are not interacting with these magnetic fields, which are what drive what I would say, the vibrational patterns, the harmonics within and how we vibrate these strings. I know you can explain all that, so why don't you go from there? Ha, that's big,
okay.
I know, but that's the theory of everything, isn't it?
Yeah. you may have to repeat a few of those questions, but I'll start with the ones that I remember. The first thing that I remember is Jared Pollack's comment. And I thought, I've heard that before, and it's a very interesting one. And his has to do with if you look at the number of basically molecules that make up us humans, we're about 99% water molecules. And the reason for that is that the water molecule is so much smaller than the other kinds of molecules that make up our body, whether they be fatty acids, whether they be proteins. A lot of our structure comes from proteins. Those are much, much, much larger molecules. So if you look at the number of molecules, then we're primarily water. And it's interesting, I'm going to digress just a minute here, that many of the ancient and even present indigenous cultures consider us to be, on a physical sense, animated water, mm-hmm. so that it's an illusion that we're this, first of all, that we're this solid being, at least a physical part of us, because we know that most of what comprises atoms is space, so we're mostly space anyway. But even beyond that, we're mostly water. So basically what we are is animated bags of water. And this is very interesting, and that the difference between different living organisms is the way that the proteins and the various other kinds of structural molecules are either structured by or structure the water. So basically the difference between us and a fern is not that we're not both mostly water, but that the water is structured somewhat different in the fern than it is in us. So from a strictly physical being, one could say that we're basically everything alive is mostly animated water, which is a totally different way of looking at life. It's a totally different way of looking at water. And in my opinion, from people I've talked to and sort of given this perspective to, they begin to look at water in a different way. Hey, it isn't just the stuff that runs out of the tap. This is basically what we are on a physical, on a physical basis. And,
right.
And different. Now, you're going to have to remind me the other parts of the question, and then I'll answer those.
Okay, well, that actually goes into the whole idea of how is it that we became a different, what I'm going to call structure or organizing system. And I know you can explain how that happened. Okay, you can start with your flow. You could talk to your eddies.
If I can do that or not. One of the things I'll have to do before I do that is go back and explain a little bit more about water. And certainly Jerry Pollack's work backs this up, and that is that water is very much both dynamic and it's very much attuned to anything that goes into it, anything that's dissolved into it, and any kind of structure that it touches or is adjacent to. And immediately when that happens, water will start changing its structure at that surface. So whether it's the surface of a membrane in the body, whether it's the surface of a biomolecule, whether it's the surface of some kind of pollutant that's been put into it, what it does is it changes that configuration, if you will, that geometry, and even that rhythm, even the vibration, if you want to call it a vibration, although we're talking about vibrations on the order of trillions and maybe even quadrillions of hertz, that is cycles per second. So what happens is that water is able to actually change its structure depending on what's around it. So in some ways, it's able to react to its environment. And so what we have here is a very complex network that's able to react to its environment in ways that some researchers have posited might even be a way of transmitting some kind of information from surfaces, from biomolecules, from radiation, from anything that goes into the water. How it might do that, we have no idea.
Can I make a comment here?
Yeah, go.
You know, this reminds me of is Bruce Lipton's work, where you know, if we're basically vibrating water and fields affect fields, then that happens at a cellular level. That happens like between you and me. It happens between me and the sun. So that all of these fields have an effect on each other. Therefore, where and who you're with makes a big difference. What you listen to makes a difference. Because basically what I was getting this visual in the last magazine I did is that the tendons of ours were like vibrating strings that were playing us. And so any sort of music, word, whatever, is dancing us. Would that be correct?
Well, yeah, that's actually very Pythagorean. You know, Pythagoras
thank you.
Came up with the idea that, basically it's the harmonics of things. It's the vibrations that can transmit information and also have to do with geometry. So this water network, yes, it will change basically the rate at which these hydrogen bonds, and hydrogen bonds are really just the connections between adjacent water molecules, and they change these things out at a very rapid rate. And if for instance, something is dissolved in water, then it forms this cluster around it, and the rate at which those adjacent water molecules in the cluster exchange bonds different than the rate at which they exchange in the network itself. So what you have is both different geometries and different rhythms or different vibrations going on within the water complex itself. And then to be even more spectacular is it can do it with billions and trillions of different things and still maintain this network. So people have even speculated whether or not the changing of these bonds might be analogous to the way that modern computer systems work, which is basically a binary system, so that the connection between any two adjacent water molecules is either off or on, either connected or unconnected. And you know, people who come from systems science and various kinds of more mathematical ways of looking at the physical world and looking at life have posed these rather grandiose questions about how water is actually functioning in a much more fundamental way than we think it might be.
Okay, I have a thought on that one. I would say, based on the stuff I've done even in my own book that's coming out, is that the gateways, it's like still resonance. And I still get to pick, like on a computer, what gateways I close and open. And I'll only open ones that I will find that will, quote unquote, resonate with me, right? So that's still a choice. And everything that we create on the outside, like you talk about hydromimicry, when biomimicry, we basically have already in multiple ways duplicated the inner workings of our own self. And so I think for them not to look, I always think with science is they never make it personal. And every time I look at this stuff, I make it extremely personal. And then when I do that, I have to chuckle.
Yeah, that's generally one of the tenets of scientific theories. It's quite personal, and it's also, I think, scientists have an extremely important role at looking at things very, very pragmatically, and obviously some very in a very reductionist kind of way, but. Having been a scientist myself and still am, I can say that science is a very valid way of looking at the universe and looking at life, but it's certainly not the only way. Humans have been understanding and dealing with and living with and creating sustainable relationships with the earth and with life for tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years, and the way that they've come to know the world around them has been not primarily scientific, but through intuitive ways and through other means of learning about the world around them. And I would say that that we've minimalized or sort of trivialized in some ways those methods of knowing the world around us. And I think at this point it wouldn't hurt us to go back to a way of sort of interacting and knowing the world in a very more personalized way to complement what we know about the world in a scientific manner. And
yeah,
I think that's go ahead.
No, I just think it's critical. I think about starts at the beginning of the show. You are in the water. You can feel it. You can sense that it was quite intimate for you. And yet when
yeah.
I know one of your other books, which is on the hydromimicry, is all the things that we're doing to be out of sync, out of the, you taught me a new word, flow forms, which create the oscillation, which create the temperature, the way that the earth regulates its own temperature, the way we regulate our own temperature. I mean, it's beautiful the way you've written so many things in your book. I love it. That's why I was so excited to interview you.
Oh, thanks. Thanks. Yeah, water is so fundamental in how we maintain ourselves, how all living things on the earth maintain themselves. And on a larger sense, looking at the earth, how it maintains itself, how it takes solar energy and converts that into energy that can be used by the biosphere, by the atmosphere, by the lithosphere, by all the compartments of the earth, and how those are all connected. It's amazing. And the whole idea behind hydromimicry is that for too long we've ignored the way in which water operates on a grand scale. If we just look at the earth itself, there's patterns that water has created due to rainfall and runoff and the way the rivers move, the way the currents in the oceans move, the way that the clouds move in the sky, the way that water has behaved on Earth, the way that it's maintained this planet for so long. And a lot of the things that we do in an attempt to try to either control water or use water in ways that we think are the most expedient, is that we go against the way that water prefers to move on the earth and prefers to create on the earth. And we overlook some of those patterns, we overlook some of those rhythms, and try to install what I call sort of brute force engineering, our ideas about how things should look, how we should build things, how we should work with water, and so forth and so on. And I think to a large degree that has caused us a lot of problems. In the beginning, it looked like they were solutions, but those solutions then came with a lot of secondary and tertiary negative effects that we're now dealing with now. And so my concept is, if we get back to looking at the way water behaves and using water in a way that's more natural, we will be able to circumvent some of those negative aspects, one of which is what we're dealing with in terms of global climate change. Because global climate change is primarily a function of what happens with the waters. It has to do with the upper level winds, which change sort of the weather patterns, and it has to do with the ocean currents, which have very much to do with setting long-term climate and temperature regimes. And those are very much a function of how the sun then interacts with the earth through the water being sort of the mediator, if you will. It mediates the energy between the sun and the earth.
There's okay, I'm going to go back to one idea because here's because I think it ties into everything. It ties into the notion of spin and the galaxies and the black holes. It also ties into like with the tornadoes. It's the engine and the things that draws the particles that helps create the form. They help create the geometry. But you also talk about how that interacts with the cycles and the sun, and everything has a spin to it, and everything is related, and we're not always, like you say, in an alignment with the rhythms of and cycles. So if we talk about these flow forms that look the same in the air as they do in the ocean, do they not?
Yes, a lot of them do. Yeah.
Yes, they do.
They're vertical in nature. Yeah, sure.
They're vertical in nature, and they still have what you call those floor forms, so that people can understand what they look like. They still look like little round dots that have the yin and yang going back and forth. If you tie these together, they go in and out, in and out. So it's positive, negative, positive. It's what creates the flow and the spin. True?
Yeah, that is. Yeah, one of the theories about vortices is that they oscillate between sort of an extended and a contracted phase. So it's going between, two poles, if you will. Yeah, however you want to describe those. Yeah.
And depending on the rotation and the spin that happens, like within these vortices of these tornadoes or eddies, galaxies, whatever, creates their geometry, depending on the relation of the spin and the speed?
Well, the spin and the speed are going to depend on a number of different things. One is the actual field itself, which is known as a vorticity field. Vorticity is the same as something like gravity, so it sets up a field in itself. The behavior of the vortex is also going to depend on the particles that are entrained. So, is it primarily water? Is it dust? Is it is it cosmic material? What it is. So, but the functioning of them, as I understand it, that you're driving at, is very much the same. Yeah.
Which then creates the geometry, which creates the fractal patterns, which create me or create a flower. Am I pushing you here, Wes?
Yeah, from a scientific viewpoint, that's a bit of a reach, but I can see your conceptual line of reasoning, and when we get to the when we look at everything, this whole idea of form and geometry, vibration or rhythm, and then if you're talking about fractality, really what we're talking about is how these occur on very different spatial scales in our bodies, on the Earth, in the cosmos, or whatever. But there certainly is a very common thread that runs through all of those, despite the fact that they may look different, despite the fact that they're on very different scales, despite the fact that the rhythms may vary from a few microseconds to many eons. We're basically looking at similar phenomena.
Aren't we also looking at things sort of unfolding like in the golden ratio?
The golden ratio, is actually an interesting one, because that's one that comes back to, something that was discovered a long time ago by mathematicians, which is the so-called phi ratio. And where they first discovered it was in looking at the leaf patterns on plants, and found that they were very predictable associated with this phi ratio. Since then, that phi ratio has been applied to a huge number of things, including a lot of the architecture that humans have created. A lot of the music is based on phi ratios, and so it appears to be one of these these ubiquitous kinds of patterns or mathematical relationships, particularly in terms of ratios, that characterizes, much of the universe, if not everything in the universe. And, trying to get to the underlying geometry, harmonics, and behaviors under those is truly fascinating, because it sort of connects everything as being related, and in fact the so-called sacred geometers of ancient times were very much convinced that everything that moved in the universe moved in a similar way and was guided by similar sorts of principles, which were quite simple.
Well, here's a question for you. This goes back to Pollock's work, because everybody's talking about this stuff called structured water. Oh, we're giving you structured water. And I'd like to say, okay, well, what structure are you giving me? What order are you giving me? That all sounds really nice. But within Pollock's easy zone, is that the zone where the structure, because he talks it like a lattice work, and he calls it crystalline, sort of like crystalline lattice, or is it not? Dr. Wayman Ho calls it a crystalline, interface place.
Well, let's see. I don't really want to talk for Dr. Pollock, but the exclusion zone, this easy zone, is one in which water excludes everything but itself. And so here we go back to water being this very interesting kind of network. And so it chooses at that point to exclude everything else from it. Now, whether it's a crystal or not depends on how one defines the crystal.
Mm.
Because a crystal has to do with the rigidity of this molecular lattice that's set up. So that's what makes it an ice crystal, or a diamond, a carbon crystal, or whatever kind of crystal you want to talk. All rocks are various kinds of crystals, like quartz is silicon dioxide. So one of the interesting things about water, and this is a good point to bring up, Karen, that water is different than any other, most other, and to the degree that it does this, any other liquid. And that is, it retains about 80 to 85% of the structure of crystalline ice. So some people have casually referred to water as being a liquid crystal, not necessarily a liquid crystal like we think of as a diode or something, that we'd use in modern kinds of electronic devices. But liquid crystal, in being a liquid, yet retaining a lot of the molecular structure of a solid or a crystal. So it's very interesting that it retains this. It's almost liquid water is very, very unique among any other kind of naturally occurring liquid that we know of in the universe. And that's one of the things that I first learned about water, which made me start looking back at ancient indigenous kinds of views of water and how they looked at it and how they revered it and how they were correct in understanding that it was much, much different and much more special than any other kind of liquids that they would come in contact with.
Well, here's a question then. You know, what I've gotten from somebody else is that if hydrogen has one and the oxygen has eight or vice versa, it's like they carry the full range of octaves. And so if we're looking at crystals as also being transducers and receivers within certain lattice structures, wouldn't that be saying that water does carry information? Doesn't that bode for the memory of water?
Well, you know, there have been so many theories put forth regarding the memory of water. One has to do with basically quasi-crystalline structures like you're talking about, and that is that if you put something in water, you get this cluster around it, which I described earlier. That is, the water is going to form a very specific kind of hydration shell, and that those hydration shells then persist for some period of time, and that information is carried in that way. Another theory that's come out, and all of these are pretty much extraneous to mainstream science. Another theory is that it's the actual interchange of the connections among the individual water molecules itself that may be in some way transmitting information. Who knows how that's received, or if it's received, or how it's done.
But doesn't that go back to your infrared, which is also a frequency? Which also carries a color, vibrates the string.
Any kind of electromagnetic radiation, like infrared, ultraviolet, visible light, all the way up, microwave, all the way up to, cosmic rays, which are, you know, one of the most high intensity. Those will all change that network structure, that those physical structures of water itself. So water is very much able to
separate all that,
quote unquote,
why they separate all
this. Why do they separate those?
Why don't they see them as all one and the same? Because they're all coming out of the same thing. That's what I find baffling.
Probably because a lot of science is done in just sort of discrete areas, discrete specialties. And so finding a mechanistic connection is sometimes difficult, and trying to get at some of this experimentally is also very difficult. You know, as you know from trying to come up with a theory of everything, you know, whether we're looking at string theory or whether we're looking at various other kinds of things. It's very difficult because some of the things that are being proposed, either some of the particles that are being proposed, some of the extra dimensions that are being proposed, some of those things are, at our particular stage here, impossible to test in an experimental way, because we just can't deal with energies and with things at that high a level. So science is sort of restricted to what it can actually show and prove. Basically, science can only look at a small part of what's going on in the universe. I mean, we know this because there's a great amount of what's called dark energy and dark matter and all kinds of things going on out there in the universe that we're not able to perceive. So,
but isn't that kind of like a joke too, in a sense, because if you actually go back and look at it, as you call it, the ethers, and what is everything made of, which is all of those three things, then don't we already have the answer and we can make up? This is one thing I did really enjoy about Gerald Pollack when I actually sat in his house and we talked. He wouldn't let a word go by, whether it's dark matter or anything, goes, what is it? What is it? If you can't explain it, then we don't know it. We can't just keep throwing words and layers on top of layers, right? Go ahead.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. And there was a book written a while. Do you know the name Irvin Laszlo?
I've heard the name.
And quite a prolific writer. He wrote about what's called the A field, which is basically the Akashic field if you want to use the Hindu, or the ether field if you want to use the ancient Greek. And basically what he was saying is, yeah, a lot of this that's going on, this mysterious stuff is really what the ancients used to call the ether or the etheric, or that portion of the manifested world that we're not able to perceive. But the problem scientifically is that because we're not able to perceive it, there's no way to measure it, so they can't acknowledge it in that way. And I think that Dr. Pollack may be right, that all these different names are just things that are given to this part of the manifested but unobservable part of our world. And it's interesting that that's exactly the part of the world that the water was proposed to be sort of the observable counterpart to. So basically water is sort of our physical connection to the etheric, if you want
to
look at it.
Okay, you know what I think that the joke is? You know, all these scientists have these epiphanies, right? They go in, and what they used to do a long time ago, as you've even said in your book, they used to know from the knowing, from the unknown. And
yes.
When a scientist actually goes in and starts working, he doesn't read his thing in a book, otherwise it would already be known. He actually goes in, he'll wake up in the middle of the night and have a dream or something. And it's like, oh, I got it. Well, where did that come from? And I chuckle because it's like, as they say, even in all the new science, there's a field that is all-knowing. It comes from what? The ethers. Sorry.
Yeah, you know, even Einstein said a lot of what he came up with was intuitive.
You know,
that intuition plays a huge part in science, and I believe it does. And I think it also, in addition to intuition, is experiential. And that gets back to the very first thing I said about water, is that my connection to water was primarily experiential. And if I can expound on that, if we can get back to a point where we're looking at water not as something that comes out of a tap or a mere substance, but something that we can experience in a real way, I think that will create a bond between humans and water that has been lost largely during the span of the industrialized age. And I think that will, in some ways, bring us back full circle to being able to not only perceive water, but to treat water in a way that will be much more sustainable for the long run.
Well, here's an interesting thing. It made me think of honoring that there are people like Victor Scheiberger who understood water in a very unique way and actually gave us warnings about if we did certain things would happen, some of the things that we're experiencing now. But there was one fundamental thing. I'm not letting you off the hook on this topic as yet because it had to do with spin. And why don't you explain? There's a lot about spin, so why don't you explain the importance of spin?
Okay, well, I'm not sure that I know. I know the answer to that one. Spin is not one of my not one of the areas that I've looked into exclusively. But spin
flow
in terms of flow forms, in terms of water movement, in terms of you know spins of particles and that kind of stuff seems to be extremely important. And there's no reason to believe that spin like everything else, isn't just as important when we're looking at some atomic particles as whether we're looking at galaxies. And I think, although I haven't looked extensively into spin itself, that, again, spin comes back to this idea of, because spin, remember, can always be related in terms of vibration or rhythm, because
right.
basically a spin is a cycle. A cycle compared to another cycle, that is a cycle per second or a cycle per year or a cycle per microsecond, is still a ratio of two cycles. And I think that basically the idea that we hear from physicists is it's all about energy, and energy is vibration, and that basically everything that comes into form is just sort of a static wave in that vibration. And that way, I think it's been said that you can take geometry, spin, vibration, any number of things, and relate those all back to some of the most fundamental things in the universe. It just depends on how you want to describe it. It's like water itself. You want to describe it molecularly as a geometry, as a network, as a fractal, as a ratio of vibration spanning 60 or 70 octaves. However you choose to explain it or describe it, there you have it.
Yep. Okay. So now here's the question that I think, you know, right now we live on a water planet.
Mm-hmm.
We're having lots of water issues. And you're talking about in your book, there's something called a closed system or an open system. And we think that we live in a closed system. And you're saying, no, we live in an open system. What does that mean?
Well, when we talk about the water cycle, generally the classical description of a water cycle is that it's a relatively closed system. So you have rainfall, evaporation, so forth and so on that go on. Of late, we know that there's some water, we don't know how much, but there's some water that comes in to the Earth from the cosmos, vis-a-vis comets and asteroids and things like that. Very early on in the Earth's history, it was considered that maybe, perhaps, a large amount of the water that's here on Earth would have come from the cosmos. There's also water that's within the solid part of the Earth itself, trapped within the crystalline matrix of rocks, or is sometimes held in some other way, in some other form, within the solid Earth. And some scientists believe that there's actually more water within the Earth than the water that we see around the Earth. And some of that water is released as through volcanoes and other ways in which very hot steam is released up through the surface, and some of that water is recycled back into the solid Earth through the movement of the tectonic plates as the plates conduct under another and heat up. So there may be water from the outside and water from the inside that feed into this hydrologic cycle. Whether or not we're going to be able to use that on a short-term scale to correct our water problems is doubtful. What we've done with water and the problems that we've created with water are strictly a function of how we've treated water and how we've tried to manipulate water in order to satisfy what we want to do, where we want to live, and those kinds of things. And those things are not going to be corrected very quickly. This sort of change in what we've done to the water is going to require some real adjustments on our part. And the idea that we're going to get out of this with strictly technology, I think, is incorrect because it's not only the amount of water, it's not only the droughts, but remember, water on Earth is basically how this system runs. And so once we start messing with the water cycle, which we have, then I think the answer is to is really what I call a hydromimicry, to look at water, to try to live in a way that uses water in a way that honors its preferences, that honors the way that it moves, the way that it cycles, and the water and the way that it creates on the earth.
There's a lot of talk, or not a lot of talk, but some talk about primary water. Can you explain? Because you're basically talking about the volcanoes there. And I'm wondering, within that idea, if there's not a dynamic of us for actually mimicking that as well.
Let's see. Primary water. Yeah, primary water is usually referred to, as I said, the water that's held in the crystalline matrix of the rocks within the universe itself. The Earth is such a dynamic system, it's not clear how we would be able to tap into that now. There may be a way to do that, to actually release that, but usually it takes a tremendous amount of energy to free up that water. And one of the things that we're looking at now is whether or not we're going to have those kinds of energy resources. For instance, one of the major arguments going on right now is since most of the world's population lives close to the, say, within 50 to 100 miles of the coast, will we in fact be able to use desalination of seawater as a way to provide us water, you know, far into the future? And technologically that may be true, but do we have the energy to do it? Certainly the fossil fuel energy we're not going to have. Perhaps if we're able to do it with solar energy or some other way like that, that might be possible. But as of right now, the energy requirements for it are fairly high. But it's interesting. There are ways in which in nature water is able to we'd be able to actually use mechanisms to desalinate water. One is in areas where seawater flows into fresh water. There's a difference in salinity between the two. Putting a membrane in between them, we can actually get water to move. We can get the water to move one way or another and create fresh water. It's sort of the idea that there are mechanisms that we might be able to borrow from nature to create fresh water that are more energy efficient and expedient than the ones we're using now.
Okay, I've got one more big question for you, then I'm going to let you off the hook. Here's the one thing that I really loved in the book too. You talked how Gaia, Mother Nature, or Earth, mimics, or we are, you show from one ocean to the other, it's the heart, and you actually go through and explain how the Earth is like we are, the blood, the veins, etc.
Yeah, I think there's a couple points, maybe 3 points. One is, if we look at the major fluid in our body other than the interstitial water, it's the blood. And for a long time, people have recognized that seawater, which is the major fluid on the surface of the earth, and blood are very similar in terms of the ratios of their chemistry, at least their inorganic chemistry. The other thing is that the whole idea of the Pacific being, as it goes through its changes through the El Nino and other things, that it's sort of that water is pumped through these currents, which are called the thermohaline circulation, or thermohaline just says that these currents move through the deep oceans as a function of differences in temperature and salinity. And so that whole idea looks as very much like you might move through the major blood vessels of the body. The other thing that's interesting is that there are temperature signals that are put into these ocean currents depending on what's going on at the surface of the earth, depending on whether we're going into an ice age or coming out of an ice age, and how much fresh water is going in to these ocean currents as opposed to seawater and the various mixing and so forth. And these temperature signals run through this thermohaline circulation that goes around the Earth, and they act as sort of cues, because when they come back up to the surface again, then they have an effect on the climate. And so in my book, I sort of ran a parallel between the way that a hormone might move in the bloodstream of a person, and the way a temperature signal might move through the major current, the major global current in the ocean. So there are definitely some parallels that can be drawn that are effective in sort of shifting one's perception of how they look at water, both in themselves and on the Earth, and the commonality between those.
I was just thinking, there's also 7 continents, right, and 7 organs. I was just flashing my head when you were saying that. I was hoping Mother Nature doesn't go through menopause.
No, but she goes through a lot of changes. I mean, at least Mother Earth, she does. She's changed. Conditions on her surface have changed a lot, and so she's no stranger to change at all.
Well, I always had one sort of insight that said, you know, where you see where I'm going to put it this way, where man has not honored the feminine, there's a lot of dry spots on the earth, in its ground. And so, oops, I probably shouldn't have said that, but I did. So I think honoring feminine design is...
I've heard that before. And
have you?
I think, oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, I'm not original then.
From a scientific perspective, I don't know, because I don't know that these spots... Plus, these regions on Earth have probably been mapped out as far as the feminine and masculine. I don't know of those specifically. But I think when we come to the larger idea of relating to the Earth, that there is more than a little importance in looking at the Earth, if not as a living being, certainly as... a very complex functioning system that has basically its own time scales, its own changes, its own movement, and respecting those. This is not just a rock that we live on. This is a living organism, and we're part of that living organism, and we. You know, all of us are a part of this, are a part of this planet. I mean, we are of the water that she is made of. We are of the elements and the electrolytes and everything that she is made of. And I think a lot of us in the industrialized Western world have lost that reverence that was so ingrained and so deep and so important, I believe, for ancient people and many modern indigenous peoples as well. And I think the degree that we can somehow experientially, intellectually, intuitionally, I don't know how we're going to do it, but to regain some of that reverence for water and the planet is essential in this time of making critical decisions about how we're going to live sustainably.
You know, what's interesting to me, when I look at, you go back to some of the ancient wisdom like we started with, and you look that everything is fundamentally and elementally made of basically the 3 things, then we realize that everything, and when that says, like in the Bible or in all the traditions, I am everywhere and I am in everything, I am that I am, that we might become to understand the importance of honoring all the elements, all the peoples, and all the traditions, and to see them as a cultural array of a beauty. But I always like to say that mothers are elemental. Mothers breathe, they breathe me, bathe me, warm me, ground me, and their space expands me. And without it, we have nothing. So with that, you know what I want to say, Wes? You've answered all my questions. Is there anything that you in particular would like to impart that I haven't asked? I always like to ask that at the end, because you know what? You've spent a lifetime dedicating yourself to the wisdom from the micro to the macro and from east to west to heart to mind. So what else is it that you might want to impart on the listeners? Anything?
Well, I think it was probably just to emphasize what I said last. I mean, as a scientist, being trained as a scientist, I enjoy the science, and I think it's pointed out some incredible things about water and the earth. But my primary reason for writing these books and doing this is to spark some recognition and some desire to actually experientially be with water, and to know it in a way that is meaningful to whoever, to the person. Mm. And I think from that, rather than from an intellectual knowledge, will come a reverence for water. And it's not going to be like the ancient ones. It's going to have to evolve from where we are at this point in time, with our knowledge, with our scientific understanding, with whatever. But I believe that that the answer to us living well and sustainably on this planet is very much a function of reconnecting to the water in a very real and a very personal way.
It seems to me that if we don't bring all these different disciplines together, which is something that all the greats did, and we marry them all up, then we're still fractured. And so it seems like the dynamics of all the different disciplines need to come together in the area to bring an understanding to the greater wisdom of water. But that's just my take on it. What about you?
Yeah, I think so. I think it comes back to this way that there's a lot of ways to know water. And I think we've become a little bit narrow in the ways that we know and understand water. And I think it's a matter of just expanding that a little bit out, farther out. It's not necessarily dropping anything that we know now. It's just broadening our perspective of it a little bit. And I think that would make a huge difference. Yeah. And I think the ancient cultures have a lot to teach us about that.
Boy, don't they ever? Yeah.
I think it's
the time right now where we're beginning to see their, I don't know, there's something to me about these ancients that it's not just something that something taught them something beyond our world. I mean, they had a knowledge that we're barely tapping into right now, and it's becoming very evident. The more I do the magazines, and I've done 33 of them, so not any one has been the same. So it's taught me a ton in the last 3 years. So with that, Wes, you have been an absolute delight. It's been a pleasure. Thank you for being able to lace. You have. I know you've been able to lace all the disciplines together for me, so I'm so appreciative. And, you're amazing. So I'm glad I found you. Thanks to Susan Alexander. And thank you for contributing to the magazines. It's been a gift to those who read it. And for those who haven't, definitely go to sciencethesage.com. Why don't you tell them your website, too, because you have tons of articles on your website, Wes, and your books.
Yeah, my website is www.watersciences.org. And from there, you can find more about me and my books and download some of my articles if you want to or whatever. And thank you, Karen, for taking
the time to
interview me, and thank you for your work as well.
Thank you.
Very much appreciate it.
Okay. And with that, we'll sign off. And thank you, everybody. Listen, if you're listening on Blog Talk, do go into the Awakening Zone. The Awakening Zone has 50 different hosts that host from around the world. And with that, we'll say goodbye. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Awakening Zone Radio Network, offering insights and inspiration for our evolving consciousness.